What are the top five jobs of the future going to be? Today, I had the pleasure of sitting down with Kate Caruthers, who is the head of business intelligence at the University of New South Wales. This conversation is packed full of wisdom. It talks to why we need to say yes, why we need to stay curious, how AI is going to change every single industry and what you can do to be prepared, the importance of emotional intelligence when it comes to leadership, and how she navigated a boardroom full of men, used her voice, and continued to get promoted. So today is one of those episodes that you really need to tune into because Kate offers a lot of value. So I hope that you enjoy this conversation today. Now to today's episode. Kate, welcome to the Career Confidence Podcast today. Really excited to have you on today. We're going to be talking all things AI, business intelligence, how you've worked your way up to your current role of the head of business intelligence at the University of New South Wales. We're going to be talking about the steps you took and how you got to where you are today. But before we dive into everything we're going to talk about, can you give the listeners a bit of an intro into who is Kate and your journey into technology and to the role that you have today? So Kate, over to you.
Thank you very much for having me, Georgie. So I'm the Chief Data Officer at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, and I'm also the Head of Business Intelligence for our AI Research Institute. And I'm not sure how I ended up here, to be honest. I started out studying history, anthropology, and philosophy, and I had no interest in computers when I was at school, and I didn't want to study them when I first went to university. So I came in contact with them in the work context, and I became really interested in them. And I had an amazing boss early on in my career who gave me the opportunity to lead the IT function when it was a very new function inside that organization, and sort of built my career up from there.
Amazing. So a couple of things. When you just said about you studied history and then you kind of got into technology. So you mentioned that you had an amazing boss, and usually the story goes that there's somebody that introduces somebody into technology. So what did that look like? Because I think there's a common theme that I speak to when it comes to the women I meet that say, oh, I haven't got a degree in software engineering, therefore I'm never going to get into technology. But your story is not the case.
Well, so can you sort of go into that bit? Why you should say yes to things when you don't know everything. So I was in the kitchen in this organization, and my boss was in the kitchen making a cup of coffee, and I said there was something quite wrong with our IT systems. And she said, you sound like you know what you're doing. Do you want to run them? And I said, yes. I did not know much about technology at the time, but I was like, I'm going to take this opportunity because I'm quite interested in it. And so I became the IT manager for this organization. It had like 400 staff. Nobody had ever been really looking after the IT systems. And so I learned on the job, and it was really great training. I learned more in the 5 years that I was there than I ever would have in another organization that had a more mature IT function. And it was just because I said yes and because I raised an issue with the boss.
Wow. Well, that's quite the story. So look, there's going to be people listening to this, Kate, that perhaps wouldn't have been able to say yes. Maybe they lacked confidence. Maybe they didn't think that they were capable or deserving of stepping into a position like that. So looking back on younger Kate in that situation, were you always quite like, did you have that self-belief from an early age? How did you develop that? Because you said yes, which is amazing, but not many people I think would have been able to say yes and take on something like that.
Well, the thing was, she didn't know anything about it. No one else in the organization knew anything about it. I knew more than them, which wasn't much. And I figured I could learn it. So I just said yes. And my career has basically been me saying yes to a whole lot of things that I didn't really understand properly when I did them, when I said yes.
The power of saying yes. I think that's going to be a big takeaway for most people listening to this podcast. So right now then, you've got a really, really interesting role, which I want to dive into. So look, technology is evolving. at a rapid pace. And some people are really fearful, other people are really optimistic about the future. So I'd love to sort of dive into like data, AI, cybersecurity. But can you sort of give a bit of an overview of what a typical day will look like for you right now? And just a bit more about your role, really sort of breaking it down into sort of what that really looks like.
Yeah, so mostly for my day job, so I'm broadly responsible for data across the university. And we think of the university in three realms. So first there's administration / enterprise systems, then there's learning and teaching and research. And research is a very special case. The other two are very similar. So I'm responsible for policy about how we manage data as an asset, how we manage data properly and securely, and I collaborate really strongly with our Chief Information Security Officer, our Head of Risk, our Head of Cybersecurity, and our Privacy Officer. So, you know, it's very much a team effort, keeping data safe in this day and age. And so we work really collaboratively, and keep telling people it's a team sport. You can't win it on your own because not every one person has the entire story about keeping data safe and also maximizing its use as an asset. So you need to think about it. If you genuinely take the first principle that data is an asset as a thing, then a whole lot of other things flow from that first principle. First of all, if it's an asset, it needs to be managed. If it's an asset, it needs to be understood. It needs to be secured adequately, which means that you need to apply things like data classification and labels onto it and make sure that it's being looked after in accordance with its level of importance to the organization.
I completely agree. And look, the word cybersecurity, obviously I work in technology recruitment and there is a lot of opportunity in this space right now. And you mentioned the word, you sort of mentioned the word teams. Can you describe what actually a good team looks like? Because so many people, myself included, I actually get a bit scared of where my data is. I have got no idea where Georgie Hubbard's data is in the World Wide Web. I don't know who it's being sold to, how it's being looked after. So how can organizations actually build out a really good team where they can really look after these assets and people's information and data? Because the breaches are happening more and more often, and it's going to continue to happen more and more often. So what actually does a good team look like, and how can we protect people's data?
Well, the first thing is if you accept that data is an asset, the first thing you need to consider is data governance. And data governance is quite simply just understanding where data is, what data you have, where it is, how it's secured, and how does it need to be secured. So it means identifying things like what we call your crown jewels, your most important things. So it might be a customer list, it might be, you know, it might be a medical database, it might be for different things for different organizations, but understanding your data and making sure that you can really make sure that it's secured adequately for the kind of data it is. So you actually need to have a fairly fine-grained understanding of what your data holdings are. For instance, struggling in your HR system. So you've got some things in your HR system which are not very, don't need to be very secure, you know, and then there are other things like tax file number or your bank account that you really don't want on the dark web. So you really need to start to understand the data within data sets and say which ones are really sensitive and be able to label them and block them from appearing, especially now with AI. If you've got something like Copilot works across your entire organization, you need to be able to say about things that shouldn't pop up. So no one's tax file number should pop up when somebody's using Copilot, for example.
Absolutely. And I think this is probably one of the hesitations around when you say AI is that obviously when it comes to like open source platforms like ChatGPT, if people are just uploading information, contracts, that can actually have a knock-on effect. You've got to be really, really careful with what you're actually giving AI. So how does that look as well? Because a lot of companies, they want to implement AI, they want to start using this new technology, but then there's this other side that says, look, we need to be really, really careful of actually what we give AI. What's your thoughts with all of that?
The first thing you need to do is if your company wants to use AI, if your organization wants to use it, you need to make sure that it's contractually protected. So, you know, if you're dealing with, say, Microsoft, you want to make sure that you're using a version of AI that's in your own tenancy, that is not going back into and feeding the public version of OpenAI, all of that. So you need to actually consider the contractual aspects of it. And for some organizations, say if you're doing things like a lot of mergers and acquisitions, you probably don't even want to be putting it into a cloud-based large language model or LLM. So, you know, you need to be considering, do you need to have an on-premise LLM that you have control over? So you've got proprietary LLM rather than putting it into a public one. So there's the public LLMs, which, you know, ChatGPT, Perplexity and all of those. You should just be putting stuff you don't care about into those. You certainly shouldn't be putting any confidential internal documents into those or anything. And then, you know, you need to have your secure cloud AIs, and then you might need to have your own on-premise secured AIs that are not connected to the cloud.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I see more and more companies doing this now, sort of like really sort of like bringing it in-house and making sure it's really secure. Because again, look, cybersecurity, huge, well, the hiring in it is just going through the roof at the moment, but also with AI coming in, it is also becoming more and more important to get all of this right and this communication piece right. So what is your thoughts? Like, how do you predict the next 5 years looking with AI coming? Like, what, I mean, I know no one's got a glass ball, right? But what excites you?
Generative AI didn't exist as a thing in the public mind. So, you know, I'm kind of loath to predict it, but I think it's going to accelerate on steroids. Like, if you think the pace of change is fast now, it will be even faster in 5 years, and that will be because of the developments in AI. And you sort of mentioned the benefits and risks of AI, and it's like all technology. It's not neutral. There are risks, then there are benefits, and the clever organizations will be able to leverage its benefits and minimize its risks. And probably the most important way that organizations need to think about that is to become data minimizers. So most organizations have been terrible data hoarders for years. They've kept all of their data, and you know, it's been on premise data sets, and you can store those. It's a sunk cost. It doesn't cost as much money. Now people are increasingly moving to the cloud, and it costs them money. But we need to shift to being data minimization actors, so that we can make sure that we don't hold data that we don't need. Because I was in most of those big data breaches, you know, the telco one, the credit card one, and the health one last year. Was it last year? Anyway, I was in all of them. I felt very, very picked upon. But the question I had was why, when I actually started doing business with those organizations more than 10 years ago, did they still hold my identity documents? Why were they still holding a scan of my identity documents when I had been well and truly identified by them and been doing business with all of them for more than 10 years? So those organizations should have been looking at their data holdings and saying, this is an existing customer. We have successfully identified this person. We should be able to delete that record, that particular record. So what organizations need to start to shift from, we'll just keep it in case we need it again, to becoming a data minimization organization.
Yeah, I think that's really, really good advice. And hopefully people listening to this that are all working for big organizations are going to take that back to the senior leadership team and say, hey, look, you know, because more and more customers are going to be concerned about what's going on. Like, you know, I used to give away my data and my information so freely. And now I'm like really thinking about it. Like, what do I actually want to sign up for? Like, how is this going to be used? Well, and it is something that's front of mind.
One thing I've been telling people for years, you don't have to tell the truth on the internet. You need to tell the truth to the tax office, to your bank. You know, there's a select number of people you need to tell the truth to. You can be Fluffy Bunny on the internet, and you can set up a Google account as Fluffy Bunny, and you can sign up to all the newsletters and have it all go to a nice throwaway email account called Fluffy Bunny if you want to. And you can have an internet birth date, which I recommend that people have. You know, I've got one that I can remember, and I use it for when they ask for a birth date. It's not my birth date. And whenever I get email that, you know, to that account that says that, I know it's from a throwaway account. And the surprising amount of times I get other emails to that account that I've got that I never signed up for is remarkable.
Absolutely. Right, georgie@fluffybunny.com is my new email. So I'm going to be going away and implementing that right now. But really solid advice, because I'm just like somebody that just adds in my email address willy-nilly, and I've just got to stop doing that, because then I get so many like random emails from people. So that's really solid advice. But going back to AI now, okay, I want to just talk about, because you mentioned the benefits and the risks. Can we kind of talk to maybe first and foremost some of the benefits that organizations could really, because I think this is going to be a huge opportunity, huge wealth generation, huge innovation, huge creativity for those that really get this, that get these next 5-10 years right. So let's talk about the benefits first of AI.
Well, AI is really going to revolutionize what organizations do. But let's just backtrack for a moment and talk about what we mean by AI, because everybody's obsessed with generative AI, which is large language models or LLMs at the moment. And they can do a lot of amazing stuff, but there are other things in the AI stack that we can and should use. And probably where the best value for organizations will be is where you stitch together generative AI plus some other things in the AI stack, like machine learning, with things like robotic process automation, so that you can automate end-to-end process and join together all your data silos at the back end, but have generative AI being almost like your front-end customer interface. So it doesn't really matter if your generative AI hallucinates a bit when it's talking to customers, as long as you've got rock-solid actual decision-making happening in the back end. So organizations are going to need to really understand what generative AI is good for and what the other AI components are good for, and make sure that they've got defensible and fair AI solutions.
Okay. So really sort of using this time to actually understand it. I think a lot of people are still, they have no idea how to use it. They're just sort of going to ChatGPT and saying, can you write me a story about my dog and my cat? They're sort of like playing around with it. They're not actually understanding how it can be used in the business. But those that understand it and get all the back end as well as the front end right are going to excel.
So one of our teachers came to me and said, I'd really like to use generative AI to mark assignments. And I said, well, how will it know what the marking rubric is? So, you know, when you mark an assignment, you get a marking rubric that's written down that tells you how to mark it. And generative AI doesn't know about that, so you'd need to connect it to that. So we actually ended up building her an app that was a proof of concept that was joining up AI with some machine learning that took the marking rubric, took a historical corpus of marked assignments, trained the ML model and the generative AI model, had quite good results, but generative AI on its own didn't understand the marking rubric. So you needed more components than just generative AI.
And they say as well, don't they, it's only as good as the person using it. So you've actually got to teach it, mold it, and help it learn, not just sort of put something in it and hope it spits out the right information. So you are actually in control of molding it, and it's only as good as the end user.
Well, and the big problem for everyone now is training data. So there is not enough training data in the world to train AI on the stuff that we want it to do. So a lot of work's going in now to building synthetic data. So it's basically multiplying the data that you've got, but doing it synthetically and using AI to do that. And so we are the last generation who've got AIs that are trained on real data. Most of the data they're training on now is synthetic. So it adds to the risk, but it also adds to the ability to train models.
Right. Okay. That's really interesting. So let's talk to some of the risks now. Like what are you concerned about as we go into this next decade and we start utilizing AI?
Well, the first thing is diversity. And we've already seen a number of examples in the last couple of years, you know, where people have built things, mostly tech bros have built things that don't include people that don't look like them. So don't take into account women, don't take into account people of color. And if we keep going forward without being more inclusive in the people who are designing this technology, we run the risks of continuing those kind of exclusionary practices, which when you think about it on a global basis, excludes an awful lot of people. It's excluding all the women and all the people of colour, that's a lot of people. So that's the first thing. We need to have diversity in our development teams, and we need to have diversity in our testing teams so that we make sure that we account. So there's an awful lot of AI apps at the moment that have not had a domestic violence perpetrator lens put over them. So there are a lot of AI apps at the moment that will literally help domestic violence perpetrators exert coercive control over their victims. And it's because the blokes who have developed these tools have never thought about domestic violence victims.
Wow. Okay. Again, these are all really important conversations, right? Which is why I have people like yourself on this podcast. Can we just keep on the D&I piece, right? Because this is what concerns me the most about the way the world's going. There's not going to be a job that's not impacted over the next, I'm going to say 5 years, right? And if we don't encourage more women and more diverse voices into this sector, we really are going to have this huge gap. And like you just said then, the problems in our society are going to get worse. Yeah. So what's in your view, and look, let's just go to your story first, Kate. What have you come up against, just out of curiosity, being a woman in technology? What's your journey been like as you sort of worked your way up in through organizations? What's been your experience?
Well, for a long time, I was the only woman in the room. I can remember one time when I was working at a large financial services organization as an enterprise architect, and we were all around a really huge board table. So it was like 30 people around this huge board table. And I looked around the room, and then a woman came in to pour coffee, and she was the only other woman in the room. And, you know, that was my experience for many years. So it's really changed since then in tech. There's a lot more women and there's a lot more diversity. We've still got a lot to do with women in leadership roles. And one of the things that I always recommend to people, like, just make sure that your job descriptions are getting run through a gender neutralizer. You know, make sure you're stripping out all the ninja words out of your jobs. And the other thing that I always do is encourage the younger women that I talk to go for jobs that you don't meet 100% of the requirements for. What we see really typically is a man can have 20% of the experience requested for a job and they will go for it, and a woman can have 90% and won't go for it. So we need to adjust our own behaviours to go for it too.
It comes back to what you were saying at the start, Kate, about how you said yes. We need to encourage more women to say yes. But on the flip side of that, and this is the side that I recruit in, society and businesses also need to change their way of thinking about what the ideal candidate looks like, what the ideal culture looks like. Because a lot of companies say to me that she wasn't the right culture fit. And I'm like, what do you mean by that?
That's the way they always reject people that don't look like them.
Yeah.
That's what they always do. So one of the other things that I recommend, if you can persuade folks to do it, is blind reviews of resumes. Like, take all the identifying stuff out of them. A lot more women get through that way. It's astonishing. We've started doing that on the academic recruitment side at the university as part of our Athena Swan initiatives. So, you know, equity initiatives. And if you take any gender markers off the resume, a lot more women get through.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. I wanted to quickly pop in and talk to you about our amazing supporter, CH Talent Solutions. We are an IT and digital recruitment company based in Australia. If you are someone right now looking for a new opportunity or considering a career pivot, please reach out to one of our consultants. Or if you are somebody looking to build your team or build your company or scale, again, please reach out to us if you are looking to find the best tech talent fast. I look forward to connecting with you. Now back to today's episode. Enjoy. Isn't it sad though that we've got to do that? like, I know it just makes me go, oh, it's like, we still there that we've got to like remove the names and everything else and have these blind interview, like CVs being sent. Like, it's just, I guess just the reality, but you know, I guess we've all got kind of unconscious bias. It's just, we need to be more aware of it. We need to, yeah, sort of start working through it, I guess. Cause I always say, well, a lot of things are caught, not taught as well.
Well, one of the things that we're going to have to watch out for is bias in our AIs, because increasingly they will be scanning the candidates' resumes, not people. So people won't be doing that in future. AIs will be doing it. We've already had experience of AIs that are biased against women in the past, pre-generative AI. So, you know, I suspect we're going to see a lot more unfairness in processes. And that's why we need to make sure that the processes can be unpacked so that they can be reviewed by humans, and that we keep a human in the loop, at least as a reviewer of disputed decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point as well. And I think that as HR professionals and as recruiters, we need to be really, really aware of these things as well. And something I've always been very aware of, something I've always been very conscious of, Kate, as I've recruited, I've always tried to strive for, you know, a gender balance in every send out I've sent. I've always tried to coach women of why they need to put themselves forward, coach my clients of why culture ad is better than culture fit. We don't just want people that look and agree with everything that the business is doing. We want diverse voices. It's good for innovation and creativity. And now the stats back that up. But look, going back to sort of organizations, right? And you mentioned that you were the only female in that boardroom. And that can be really, really intimidating. So let's just say a woman's listening to this now. She is in a very male-dominated company. What advice would you have for her to make sure that she is getting her voice heard, she is feeling seen and valued? Like, how did you navigate that boardroom, if you could think back to what you used to do?
Yeah. Luckily I was brought up with four brothers, so I was used to wrangling a bunch of males. And I always ignored the gender elephant in the room and just spoke my mind. And I had people even say to me, you can't say that. I just said it. But you need to keep in mind that we know that men overestimate the amount of time that women speak. So if women speak for a small amount of time, men overestimate that. I just ignored them. I just played my straight bat. Using a cricket analogy, I played a straight bat and just did my job. And what I did was something that I don't recommend women do, is I often took really basket case projects and brought them back to life. So, you know, I made my progress by doing that sort of thing, but that was because I have ADHD and I like that sort of thing. I like a crisis. It cheers me up. A lot of people don't like that. So don't do that unless you really like it, is my advice. But the other thing is find your women peers and start to form networks. So there was one bank that I worked for where a bunch of us women in middle management started talking to each other, and we realized that we were being all paid at the bottom of the salary bands, which were $40,000 deep. We were being paid $40,000 less per year than men who were being paid at the top of the band, and we were all at the bottom. And we went to the bank and asked them to fix it, and they said no. So I just went and found another job for $40,000 more. Now, that meant that I had to go assess my skills, assess what I needed, what certifications I needed, and work towards it. It took me a year to find it and to get my certifications and my resume right for it. But I just was like, I'm not going to stay here and accept this. So I went and found another job that paid $40,000 more.
It's a perfect example, Kate, of knowing your worth. And I want you to understand how powerful that story is, because like so many women might have just gone, oh, well, I'll just accept that. But you didn't. And I think these stories need to come to light. They need to come to the market, because why should we accept $40,000 less? I know when I found out when I was working at my last company that I was on a lot less than my male counterparts, and plus I was bringing in triple the revenue than what they were. I was like, excuse me, I want more money, please. And this is why. And they didn't really have a choice but to give it to me. But had I not have known that, had I not have taken the reins and gone and spoken to my boss, that would never would have happened. And these are the stories that we need to tell, because there is a gender pay gap. We've just seen it. All of the report came out. And women, and it's interesting because I'm speaking to women and like, well, I don't know what to do about it. I don't know what how to speak to my boss or my HR team. I was like, you just need to have the conversation.
Yep.
You just do. But I love what you said then about the women all coming together. And I think this is why these employee resource groups within organizations are really powerful. So one of my clients is 7-Eleven. They have a TechWise group, and it's all the women in tech that come together once a month to talk, to share, and just to be in that really safe space. So these things that companies can do to really support the women is absolutely fantastic. And yeah, I just think that's such a powerful story, what you just said then. But just keeping on this gender piece just for a moment longer, because what I do want to encourage is more women to come into this industry. Have you got any thoughts of how we can get more diversity into tech? Is it going to be the grassroots, you know, targeting young girls? Is it going to be targeting more women and getting them to pivot and have a career transition into tech? Where do you sort of see what could happen? What could be improved upon to get more women into this industry?
I think we need to do everything, all of the things. so we need to get to girls in when they're at the end of primary school, start of high school, and get them to do maths, because if they do maths all the way through, they have choices. Now, I didn't do maths all the way through, so I had fewer choices than if I had done that. So, you know, technology would have been a hard pivot for me to pivot to at university because I didn't have maths. I've since done a whole lot of stats courses and maths courses at university. So, you know, I've caught up. But it put me behind the eight ball because I didn't have maths. So if we can talk to our daughters and say, keep maths and keep it through. I know it's not fun for most of us, but some people adore it, but I never liked it. And, you know, just have somebody tell you early enough so that you can make that decision and carry it through. So that's the first thing. Girls do maths. The second thing is that you need to pick the careers that are hot. And the two hot careers in tech for the next decade, I predict, will be cyber and data. And I've actually been recommending a lot of my friends who have ADHD to get into cyber because they love the fast pace and all the changes, and normal people get a bit depressed because it's a constant onslaught of new attacks. But it's a great option if you're neurotypical in some way. So cyber is really great. And data is not just data and data analytics. It's AI now. So all my data engineers are retraining as AI engineers. So, you know, there's a real trajectory for people into the future to be the builders of AI. And so data is really an interesting area. But you need people like business analysts. So you need people who can talk to human beings and translate it for the techies. So that's a really big pivot option for people. We need testers. So we need people who can find problems. Like, I'm a really good tester because I always find all the problems when I'm testing apps. If you're one of those people, that's a great pivot. So it's an easy pivot into a business analyst or a tester role, even if you're not technical. So there are a couple to be thinking about, and also project management. So we need people to manage projects. We're going to need scrum masters and agile coaches and stuff as well. So there's a couple of ideas for people who would like to get into tech but aren't coders. So tech is not just coders. There's plenty of opportunity if you want to learn coding. There's plenty of resources around to do it for free. But project management, business analysis, and testing are just a couple of areas that people should think about if they want to move into technology and don't want to sit down coding. I don't like coding because I'm a very bad coder and I always spend all my time trying to debunk my code. But, you know, I know how code hangs together. If I keep joking with my team, if I'm cutting code, we're doomed. We are literally doomed because I'm so slow and so inefficient at it. But It's an important thing to understand that we need diverse views and we need diverse people. And if you just think about all the people who go and study computer science and go through to the end, they come out with a particular mindset, the same way lawyers do. You know, lawyers go in one way and pop out as lawyers. So we need to bring other people's perspectives to this, going back to the thing that I said right at the start of diversity, because product teams need product managers, project managers, business analysts and testers as well. And that's where we can bring in a lot of the diversity and viewpoints and add a lot of value to the development process.
I absolutely agree with every single thing you just said there. And there's actually some amazing stories. So you mentioned cybersecurity. I've talked to two women on this podcast that both were nurses. One went into cybersecurity because she identified that there was actually a lot of threats happening even in her place of work. And she got fascinated by, God, can you imagine if someone hacked this medical system right now, what would that actually do? And she kind of started to really be interested and invested in all of the threats that could come in. And then she went into cybersecurity. Then I interviewed another woman who then went into cloud engineering. And these are stories of women that don't have tech degrees, that have been nurses and now are having thriving careers in technology. So there might be a woman listening to this right now that wants to get into tech. She doesn't have a technical degree. She doesn't have a math degree. Maybe she's a nurse. Maybe she's a teacher. What advice, Kate, would you have for those types of women who want to transition into tech? How could they go about making that first step?
Well, the first thing to look at is study the area that you're interested in. So if it's cybersecurity or cloud engineering or whatever, research it. Like, don't Google it. Google's kind of broken at the moment. It says DuckDuckGo because it's Bing. Anyway, search it up on the internet. Try to get to understand it, and then look at what certifications are available, and also look for the free online training. Like, all the big cloud platforms have free online training, really good free online training. You can learn all three of the major clouds for free in your spare time. So go leverage all the free training that's available, but then identify which certifications you think would be good. And don't forget that universities often have four subject graduate certificates that you can get into in those things. So cybersecurity, testing, project management. So you can get your feet wet at an academic level with just four subjects.
That's it. And there's so many free resources out there right now. So if you want to start, you can. There's just so many options out there, free online courses, certificates, training. I guess the thing that is just what companies need to then be really aware of is to give people a shot. Because I do find that sometimes the companies that I'm sort of recruiting for, the business I'm speaking to, is like, we need 3 years experience in this. And it's like, well, unfortunately, if we want to get more talent in this space, we need to kind of maybe give people an opportunity to come in and just give them the opportunity to just learn as well on the job and implement what they've learned. And we need to do that, because otherwise we're not going to get the talent. It's going to be such a tiny talent pool. And then the prices are going to go, just then companies aren't going to be able to afford to hire these people. And we're going to be in this vicious circle. So we need to start being open to other ways that we can bring in talent into this industry. And one of them, I agree, is doing online courses and really sort of, I guess, people going away and doing their own research and their own learning as well. So just a key thing there when I'm thinking about the organizations that I've recruited for in the past, where they've said they want 3 years or 5 years experience. And I'm going,
I've got a funny story about that. I know a guy who invented a programming language, and he got pinged on LinkedIn by a recruiter, and the job spec said, we want 10 years experience in this language. It had only been invented 3 years earlier, and he invented it, and they knocked him back. It was just the most ridiculous thing. And so, you know, organizations with these ridiculous asks for jobs, like, why is 10 years of a language that was only invented 3 years ago? Did HR write that job spec? You know, so asking for what is necessary in the job, and like in this market, like, you can't find your unicorn person. So understanding, like, what I always do is I don't recruit for technical skills. I have a list of things that we want, and if we get them, that's great. But what I hire for is some kind of aptitude. So if I want a particular language, do they know something else? Have they learned a couple of other languages? If they've learned three other languages, they can learn this one too. What I look for is teamwork. So I want someone who's a team player. I want somebody who plays nicely with others. I like people who have initiative and get up and go. And I like people who are not afraid to learn new things. So they're the things I really recruit for. But the technical skills, if they've learnt one, they can learn another one. They can learn that pretty quickly. And so I don't really go for the deep technical skills. Like, I even hired somebody for a data analyst role a couple of years ago, and she didn't have SQL skills. But we give them a test in the language we're recruiting for. But she had a really interesting approach to how she would solve our SQL problem. So even though she didn't know SQL, she had a really interesting approach. And I was like, let's get her in for an interview.
It's really refreshing, Kay. And it is happening more and more. And I'm very choosy with actually the clients I work with. But I'll give you a scenario the other day that I came up against. So it was a CTO, and he said to me, Georgie, he said, when it comes to the tech, the hard skills, give me someone who's a 6 out of 10. But when it comes to the emotional intelligence piece, critical thinking, adaptability, resilience, I want someone who's about an 8. And I was like, right, this is refreshing, because these human skills now are being really, really sought after. So that's what I'm saying to the people that I'm recruiting for, like, work on your softer skills, aka your critical skills, because they are also the skills of the future. And that's what companies are also looking for as well. How are you going to come in, how you communicate, how you can speak to the rest of the team. Like, these are all really important skills. Which brings me on to my kind of final sort of questions, Kate. Like, you are in a leadership role. You're leading a team, you're, you know, very high up in the organization you work for. What do you think in terms of the leadership, when we think about the leaders of the future, what kind of skills should they be working on? What kind of skills should they possess in this new world of work?
Well, like whatever you knew about AI from 2 years ago is dead now. So you're going to be on a constant learning journey from the technology perspective. But, you know, I think you hit it on it really perfectly. EQ, so emotional intelligence, will be key. How to manage and get the best out of people. Like, I've led technical teams for a long time, and one of the things that's people like to work with me because I don't micromanage them. But the amount of people that micromanage technical teams is just astonishing. It's the littlest thing, but if you don't micromanage people, they do amazing things for you. So I think management and supervisory skills, which is, you know, Not a lot of people get promoted to supervisory and management positions and don't get any training. So if you do get promoted to those sort of things, try and get some management training. Try and get your organization to provide it for you. If you can't, you know, do some research, subscribe to the Harvard Business Review, get some understanding of how to motivate people. Because in a lot of organizations, I used to work in banks. In banks, you could just bully people. You could just go, I won't give you your bonus unless you do X. And that was really easy, very transactional. And when I went to work in the state government, public service, you couldn't fire people. It was like a 2-year process to fire someone. So you had to try and shift their mindset using motivation. You had to motivate them to want to change. And I had a team of project managers, and they went from leaving at 4 p.m. on the dot to go catch their train to them being in the office at 6 and me saying, what are you all doing here? Go home. We said, I just want to finish this one thing. And they had this total mind shift change because I'd been able to articulate a mission that they could buy into, and they wanted to be part of it. So that's the kind of leadership we need, of building teams, being collaborative. And I think the future is collaborative teams and collaborative cross-functional teams, because increasingly in the world of AI, it's not just AI, it's security, it's risk, it's privacy, it's all of, and data governance, it's all of those working together in keeping the data safe. So, you know, I think the future is teamwork, and that's why playing nicely with others is probably the most valuable skill you can teach kids.
Completely agree. It all goes back to that praise over punishment, isn't it? I think if you're constantly like reinforcing things that people are doing well, they're going to want to do more of that. Whereas if you're constantly like threatening, punishing, micromanaging, you don't get the best out of people. And I've worked in organizations that do that and you end up leaving. Like, you know, no one wants to work in that environment. And I just think the future of work and the future organization is exactly what you're describing. It's collaborative. They've got good cultures. They've got very emotionally intelligent leaders that want to get the best out of their people and have got a really motivated team. So I absolutely love what you just said then as well. But the final question as you were speaking there, because one of the things that keeps on coming up when I'm speaking to leaders is the whole sort of working from home hybrid place. Like, where do you see that having a role in our future? Do you think that it's here to stay? I mean, some companies are mandating back in office because they're saying, oh, it's good for culture to have everyone back in the office. Where do you sit with this, Kate?
So before COVID, I managed global teams and I managed teams. Like I had one team where they were in Melbourne, Sydney, Chicago, LA and London. I've had other teams with people in Poland and Mexico as well, you know, all over. And we built exceptionally good team culture such that even when I went to LA to visit the team after I'd left the organization, we all stayed in touch. They met me at the airport and gave me hugs. Like that's pretty good relationships. So people say, oh, you can't build real relationships. Well, you can. You can build excellent relationships. It comes down to the quality of the communication and the quality of the relationship that's established. And you need to do that really consciously. So pre-COVID, I had this position. And post-COVID, I think any organization that is just trying to reflexively get everybody back into the office is doomed to failure. Because people have now had a taste of the benefits of a hybrid workplace. And I'm always saying, I want my people, when they go to the office, to spend time with their stakeholders. Like I tell them, if you're sitting at your desk when you're in the office, that's a waste of your time. You can be sitting at your desk at home. Go out, have coffee with people, walk around, meet people. Like the face-to-face is still important, but we need to make sure that we're doing it consciously and thoughtfully.
I completely agree. Intention. I think that if you're going to come in with intention, if you're going to come in to mentor the junior developers or the junior data analysts, if you're going to come in to work with the stakeholders, if you're going to come in to work on a particular project that day, absolutely worth your time going in. But if you can do exactly what you're doing at home, you've just commuted for 2 hours or 3 hours or however long it takes you to get into the office, for what purpose? That's kind of a lot of people's arguments, right? But look, I see the benefit of both. Absolutely. I don't necessarily agree with completely remote, but I also don't agree with mandate back to office. I think that there's a nice blend when it comes to hybrid.
I agree too.
And I think what you said earlier, Kate, which I love, you said you don't micromanage. It's just coming down to trust. Just trust people to do their job. I think we're all adults. Give people trust. Don't micromanage. Get out of people's way. And generally, I do think people want to do a good job if they're in the right environment and they're working for the right team and leadership. So just enable them to do that. I think that's sort of where I come from.
I think you're right. So going back to what I said earlier about, you know, building teams and building environments where psychological safety is the normal experience. So people can be rolled. They can say what they think, but still be respectful, is so important to getting good outcomes. Because one of the things you get when you have psychological safety is people tell you when things are going wrong. And if you're operating in a fear-based environment, often people let things go wrong and then tell you afterwards, I knew that was going to happen, because they didn't feel psychologically safe about telling anybody, which is not very good for anybody. And it's not very good for them psychologically.
Yes, absolutely. And I've worked, I know, quite a few organizations that unfortunately people don't feel safe. And like I said, they end up leaving, they don't do their best job. And it's like we do really want to create those fair and inclusive cultures where people do feel safe and feel like they can bring their best self to work. I think that's absolutely key. But Kate, where can people find out more about you? Where do you hang out the most? Where can I send people that want to connect?
You can find me on Mastodon and Blue Sky nowadays. My website, katecarruthers.com, is where you is my home on the web.
Amazing. We'll make sure we put all the links below. And don't email Kate at fluffybunny.com because she'll think that you're you're a scammer. But Kate, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. And keep on spreading your message. Keep on raising your voice because we need more women in leadership like yourself. And that's how we're going to create change as well. Because a lot of people can't be what they can't see. So keep on shining and keep on being a voice for women. That's how we're going to change the voice of technology. So thank you so much for coming on today. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you've got this far, that honestly means the world to me and lets me know that you've got a lot of value from today's episode. So if I could just ask you to do one thing, pull out your phone and please leave a quick review. It honestly would mean the world to me. It will help this podcast grow and get our message out there to more people. So if you could do that for me, that would be amazing. And please reach out and just let me know what you want to hear more about, what you're interested in. It will just also help me make sure that I'm continuing to speak to topics that are relevant and also find guests that are real true experts in what you want to know more about. So have an amazing day. Thank you so much for doing that. And I can't wait to share the next episode with you. Thank you.